What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Throw your whip in it now. Fill your body up tight. Walk it hard and long. When you finish that,
the hip knocker.
Episode 167 of the Talking Bollocks podcast brought to you by Go Loud. It's me, COB.
It's me, Tardy Flower.
And today we're joined by...
Caroline Foran. I actually wasn't sure if you guys just didn't know my name there.
No. Let the guests introduce themselves, Caroline. That's how it works.
Yeah. What we have to be talking about, Calvin?
So, usually we'd be like, oh, Caroline, how are you? How's your day? Yeah. But we're at being deep in conversation because today is a pre-recorded episode. It's the 29th of February. And then we go down into the nitty-gritty of why there's a 29th on a leap year. And
what happens if it's your birthday and you're born on a leap year day?
Yeah.
So can anyone out there who, surely someone has to be born on the 29th of February who listens to this or know somebody who is born on the 29th of February, what day do you celebrate your birthday? Because I think this could be actually a zinger.
Yeah, but me and Cardline were saying...
I love how you say my name.
Boy,
Cardline? It sounds like Coddle.
Cardline?
How my nanny used to say it. Cardline.
Yeah, Cardline. I'm a townie.
I love it.
But we were asking why there's a leap year.
Yeah.
And the cabin was explained there's a quarter.
We still don't get it though.
So childish. So a year is how long it takes the year to go around the sun, right?
Yeah.
One full circle around the sun, or whatever shape it is, yeah? It takes 365 and a quarter days for the year to go from A all the way back around to A again.
Okay.
On the map, yeah.
But why don't we just pretend that quarter day?
It just doesn't exist. Like, just add a few days on the end.
Yeah.
Well, we are. Yeah. Well,
why would they not just add it on, like, to the end of December or something? Like, why are they doing it in the middle of what month? Are we February?
February. It's just there's 365 and a quarter.
Why
did
they pick
so
February?
Every 4 years, it adds
yeah.
Up.
Why February? Because that's the shortest days.
Yeah. Otherwise, you're like 32nd of January.
Oh, we couldn't do that.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
You could make Christmas you could make June longer. Why aren't we making a summer month longer?
Oh, she's onto something, Calvin. You can't take her away, man. She's onto something.
But then yous were already going on about removing days of the week and months, and Terrence said remove 7 o'clock.
I don't like 7 o'clock in the day. I don't like Tuesdays and I don't like April. I'm not saying we should, but I'm just saying, like, if I'm going to bleed and add a day on here, why don't we
take a few away?
Take Tuesday away.
That's what they done back in the day. That's where the calendar came from.
Yeah, I just think they overcomplicate everything.
A few months in, do you know that?
What?
Who did?
Yeah.
There's only 10 months.
Don't say you just didn't know this.
I didn't know that.
Come on. Enlighten us, Calvin.
So July and
that's
August.
That's my cowhouse card.
July and August got added into the calendar based off Julius Caesar and Caesar Augusta. They added them 2 months in. So that's July for Julius Caesar and August for Caesar Augusta. That's why in Latin, do you never think about the days, the numbers? So September is 7, October is 8. November is 9 and December is 10. They were the months. And then they added into that.
Oh my God.
Oct is E.
Like in German.
Octo, yeah. An octave is E. Yokes in whatever in music. Ocho is 8 in Spanish. Am I right there, Lauren? Ocho is 8 in Spanish.
Otto is Italian.
Yeah. So that's E is oct. And then dies is 10 in French. They all derive from Latin. So DEC is the... 10.
Like, how did they divide up the seasons though?
I don't know. I'm just letting you know. This is where
you
the calendar came
else.
From.
Yeah. Just don't know we're all. Tell us how the seasons fucking work.
So when do you think summer, like, did they made it longer for summer?
No, they just put it in because them two fellas, like, ruled
wanted
the Roman Empire and were like, this is the new calendar we're going with. Boom. Don't give a fuck when your birthday is. We're putting these 2 months in. That's it.
But celebrate their birthday.
I like that. The boys are just coming in, putting months in, taking stuff away, doing what they want. Julio
Have you
Caesar?
Ever heard Julius Caesar? Julio Caesar. He's from Blade, Mexico. Have you never heard that theory as well, that we should have 13 months and there should be 28 days in each month? And every month will start on a Monday and end on a Friday. So the 1st will always be a Monday and the 28th will always be a Sunday. Sorry, if they were out that way.
But who's in charge of all that?
Now,
who can decide to do that?
I don't know, but didn't the Mayans have a calendar and their calendar reset and everyone's like, the world's going to end? It's like, no, it just starts again. It's like the 31st of December. Let's just start there again.
What I would like to see happen is daylight savings time.
Get
gone.
Rid of that. We are
but
in a conversation
but who, card. But who does that? Who decides?
Wait, what's this? The forward and back?
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
But remember, we talked about how people bottle it.
Not when you have a kid. Absolutely torturous.
I feel like the clocks are going forward already.
It was
half 5 the other day I was coming in here. Sorry, last week half 5 I was coming in here. It was pitch black. Come in here yesterday at half 5 it was sun was splitting.
Grand
still
bright stretch. Out now, look.
I'm still bright out now, yeah. Mm. Half five.
Yeah.
It is about to snow, though.
That's a valid point. But we also had this conversation. Do you remember a few years ago, the EU put it to a vote so you could pick country by country if you wanted to keep the daylight savings?
No.
And then we were like,
imagine every day's like, a school day.
Imagine like France kept it and then like Holland yeah. didn't and Germany kept it. So you're like, it'd be 10 o'clock, then it'd be 9 o'clock, then it'd be 10 o'clock again.
Even then, though we're all in the same
yeah,
like vertical.
Yeah. And then they said they didn't do it because of COVID. Because apparently COVID affected if you could put your clocks forward back off. So yeah, here we are.
I don't know like if it would be better to have an hour in the morning or like, would you want a brighter morning all the time or a brighter evening all the time?
We're winter fellas.
I'm a winter person as well. I come yeah. alive in the winter.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like when it's dark, yeah, like when you too. Wake up and it's dark at yeah. 4 o'clock.
But I can't wait for that to come around. But I can't wait for it to go forward as well. I'm like, summer is here. And then I hate it 2 weeks later. And then winter.
Every time it gets to the 21st of June, my husband is like, don't say it. And I'm like, the evenings are going to start getting shorter.
Yeah, yeah. People saying
like,
a name.
Yeah, I feel like the winter was just gone this year. We yeah. didn't get a winter.
Yeah.
It was like summer up until November.
Well, that's because it's only going to start now. Like climate change is a whole other conversation, but that's, I think winter is happening now and spring happens at summer and summer happens in autumn and winter is actually now just autumn.
Sean, to something. Card Lion.
Yes.
You've interviewed some of the most famous people in the world.
Mm.
We interviewed Coolio.
Mm-hmm.
I heard a little story about you and Coolio. I don't know how true it is. Do you want to tell us?
It's a rumour going around.
It's a rumour going around. Well, I don't think he can sue me now. And I don't know if I remember it correctly, but...
Ah, that old chest. Oh, it's a bit funny. Earlier on, you were giving key details. Timestamps and all.
What he was wearing. So I used to work in entertainment.ie. You know, you used to look up for the Cinema Times. They used to do... Well, they do a lot more than that. And the office was above a tattoo parlour in town. And... I was on my way into work and everyone was like, Coolio's downstairs, he's downstairs. And I said, right, we're going down. We're going to get the scoop. We're going to get some sort of like exclusive story. And I went down and he hadn't just arrived for his morning tattoo. He was there on a rollover since the night before. Yeah.
His morning tattoo was if it's a daily thing.
Probably was.
Going up with a cappuccino and a tattoo.
Yeah. And I went in with one of my co-workers and it was just a very weird vibe. Like we were... had just had our cornflakes. We were not on the same level at all. And the rest is a little bit hazy, but I got the sense that we should probably get out of here where there's not much, like he's not going to give us a juicy story, except for the one that I couldn't share, which is that one of his people was like, Coolio would like you to come back with us or to wherever. And I was like, I actually have to go. My boss is waiting for me upstairs. So I got out of there. But I just love telling people that Coolio asked me out. I have a photo. I actually have photographic evidence of us together.
Right, so you can prove that part. Yeah. That's what I'm hearing now.
Yeah. Hands up where evidence, yeah.
Yeah, I'm like, no,
the statement. Yeah. Who else was there?
I want the messages.
the DMs, yeah.
Who is? Why do you look like that?
I don't know what's coming. And do you know what? When I was doing all those interviews, it was at a time when the studios who were organising the interviews were so careful of who they'd send in case you spun anything or said anything.
Yeah.
It had to be so much about the movie. And I was such a good girl that I never went in looking for the goss or the, you know, going for the jugular. But you'd have different experiences, obviously. And I didn't dare talk about it at the time because you didn't want to get blacklisted and then never sent something again. And to be honest, you only get like, you're flying over at 4 a.m, arse crack of dawn for 4 or 5 minutes with someone who couldn't be bothered.
Yeah.
And again, the cameras are rolling. And if you ask for a photo, they take a minute off you. So it's like,
fuck off.
Yeah. Do I want the photo or do I want the extra minute? And you want the photo, obviously.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a lot of bollocks. I don't like that.
I remember, I think it was Henry Cavill for...
Had to be a Superman.
Yeah. Something like that. And I was like, no, I really would like a photo with him. And I was like, right, well, then it's down to 3 minutes. And I was like, I think it's worth the photo.
So, like, what happens if you go to the 4 minutes and they take and they got a picture, you just get told the fuck off?
People will just jump on top of you and be like, that's it. No, thank you. And like, it never happened to me because I was always a bit scared. I always kind of I actually have so few photographs because some of you just know when you go in, you know if they're going to say yes or no, and it's going to be mortifying if they say no, and then you feel like a fucking idiot leaving, and just you feel you're just kicking yourself all day.
Would you get in trouble then when you go back and like if your boss or editor is there and be like, Caroline, you only asked like 5 questions, you're supposed to ask 8, and you'd be like, yeah, but I got a selfie.
No, I never did because, well, I never got in trouble with the studios because I always asked like bloody boring questions about the actual movie they're there to promote. So in that way, they loved sending me for that reason. But no, I didn't get in trouble. I always was like, oh, your WhatsApp, tell us about the actual movie and who cares. I could now when I see how people interview, like it was before the age of podcasts, it was before like having real honest chats. I'd say they're so much more guarded now though, because of the way people go in looking for that viral moment. It was so different then. But you were going to ask me who was what, the nicest, the worst?
Who's the most famous person that you ever interviewed? I like the way she has to think about
it. I don't know if who's like the most famous, but...
Wait, who's the most famous person you've ever had on the podcast?
Coolio.
Or, no, I was thinking Eddie Hearn. Eddie Hearn is like global.
Right.
So was Coolio though, in fairness. Coolio is global.
Oh, no, of course he is, but like in the 90s. I shouldn't say that. Because I said that to Coolio. I
know you haven't listened to an episode of the podcast, but I'd highly recommend going back and listening to that episode.
Don't say that. Everyone will hate me.
No, they won't.
No, don't worry. 90% of the people we have seen that she hasn't listened to this podcast. So you're grand.
No, Caitlin told us that she doesn't really listen to many podcasts. But that's
not because
from
I
would
like to. It's just I barely listen to my own.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah. But you don't have to justify yourself to us. Okay. But go back and listen to that.
I will.
Great moment in that where Taryn says something to Coolio. Coolio gives back the best answer I've ever heard in my life, and the tension was through the roof. I was sitting there like just looking at the floor.
Oh my God. What was he promoting? Was he just having
Coolio being Coolio.
He was over here with the Versatile boys, and we know the lads, so we got on to the lads and asked them would they bring Coolio over, and they were like, yeah, he's up for it. We were like,
great.
Lovely.
I should have got him while I could.
Yeah.
Would have probably gone a bit
now, don't you?
Would have went back to the gaff.
Yeah. You could have had a better story to tell than I blanked him.
Bring my little Marantz recorder.
Yeah. Yeah. You still haven't answered.
Sorry. Okay. Yeah. Well, there's not really like a most famous, but there's like a level of famous, I suppose, like Johnny Depp, Tom Cruise. Like that's probably like you think of celebrities or famous people, you think of that, right?
Are they all?
Like, Gwyneth Paltrow, Justin Timberlake.
Yeah.
They
it's probably
arseholes.
Hard to think, like who's sound and who's not sound because you've
no,
4 minutes with
them
all. It's
very easy to know who's sound and
oh, really?
Sound. Yeah.
But like who's the soundest and who's the least soundest?
I would say Justin Timberlake and Gwyneth Paltrow.
They're cold.
And so basically when you walk into a room and it's, you know, it's set up like this and there's a million people and they're, you know, everyone's kind of fussing and... If you don't say like, oh, hi, how are you? And, you know, you shake the hand and have the little bit of initial chat before the cameras go on. It's just, you can cut the tension. It's awful. And the people, the celebrities who would say, who give you the time of day, basically, and appreciate that you've gotten up and flown over for 4 minutes of their time when they're getting paid millions to promote this movie. This is the last little bit of work they have to do. The people who don't do that to me, I'm like, nah. And just kind of really give you difficult answers or aren't friendly. Like, I don't know. Is it that much to ask that you just like, even if you hate doing press, put on a smile. So Justin Timberlake didn't look up from his phone and I was like, how are you? And he was like, fine. And I was like, you're a prick. I still listen to his songs, but,
no, but
I don't like him.
A prick move.
It was a prick move.
Look, I understand. Like you said there, like it probably is frustrating to be sitting there all day answering questions, probably the same question a million times.
Yeah, but you're getting paid so much money. It's your job.
I know, but I don't even take the whole job away. Like, I think it's common decency in life if someone is talking to you to just bleed and look at them and answer.
And acknowledge them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I did. Well, sometimes there was a theory that the bigger the star, the smaller the ego, because they had been around the block enough and they would have enough experience and they would appreciate it. Like, for example, Tom Cruise was... Now, I know people have their opinions about him being a nutter or whatever, but he takes so much time with everyone. That was a red carpet one. And he will give you the time of day. He will engage. He will listen. He will look you in the eye. And that means the world when you're standing there shivering in the rain for 10 hours trying to get, you know, a clip. So Johnny Depp also, I know there's people have their opinions about him. He was so nice. And I brought him a little present from Ireland. And I was like, this could go so awkwardly. But it was a little, some stupid Irish thing in the airport. And he loved it.
You shame me, he's the best man.
Oh sure, he was at the funeral. I saw. Yeah,
he was his best man at his wedding, and that was the most random mistake.
They just met in a bar or something, didn't they?
He was his best man at his wedding, so like he probably has a soft spot for Roland.
Oh yeah, he does. He seemed to really have a soft spot. The likes of Gwyneth Paltrow then was another just like I will engage once the cameras are on, and I have to. Well, once I'm obligated to give you the time of day, I will. But before that, why would I bother? And that just to me is like nah.
Wasn't she selling that bathwater or something though? So
no, her vagina steaming.
Yeah. What was that all about?
What?
No, sorry, she wasn't selling
a candle or something, wasn't it?
Who was she?
Yeah,
she's
Gwyneth Paltrow.
Terrence has seen about 10 films in his life.
We're on a journey. I think I'm at about 15 films ever now.
My god. So you don't know, probably don't know any of these names.
You know everyone there bar Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yeah,
Justin Timberlake.
Yeah,
Tom Cruise.
Never seen a film with John Tom.
You know who he is,
Tom Cruise.
You've never seen a film with Tom Cruise
or Johnny Depp. Never.
But you know who they are.
Okay, we'll go back and watch Cocktail.
Cocktail.
Never seen that. I've never even heard of it.
Tom Cruise in the early days. Go back. It's a treat.
Right. Give me a Johnny Depp film. I know he's in that.
Oh, that
Pirates of the Caribbean.
That,
yeah.
No, that's shocking.
And he's deadly in that, though.
No, he is deadly. But what's the one with him and what's her name?
Yeah,
I hate when this happens. The drugs one.
Yeah, Blow.
Blow. Yeah, brilliant.
That's good film.
Yeah.
And it was the movie, it was a Lone Ranger, it was a Disney movie, it was shite, and that was what Johnny Depp was in with this other guy, and of course his name's going to escape me as well, but he's the guy who ended up being famous, like having notoriety for like being a bit of a cannibal or something. You won't know who he is. Armie Hammer. This is me never getting to do an interview ever again with anyone promoting a movie.
Okay.
Yeah, and he was lovely and he was gorgeous. And I was like, absolutely, he's my wild card. And then all this stuff comes out in the press that he's like chopping up toes. And
wait, we skip past this whole thing about the board with the vagina stain.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. As if like, that was a thing. You should have been. Yeah. But she was selling like candles or something.
She has a vagina smelling candle.
Of her vagina or something, yeah.
No, I think it's maybe...
Well, she's an actor.
No, it's like a jade egg that you shove up your vagina to like... soothe it or I don't know.
But she was selling
she steams her vagina like regularly. Yeah, she's now super famous, not for her acting skills, which she was like really good at, but for being like just a pain in the hole with she's just a pain in the hole.
She's very like out there about that, and you're like, are you okay?
Yeah, she's probably not okay. She wasn't okay. She needed a hug and she needed a pint of Guinness.
Yeah, no, she did, and she needed a bottle of Cop on, like, yeah. She's Tony Stark's wife in all the Iron Man films.
I interviewed her. Actually, that was for that movie.
Did you meet?
No, he
strikes me as someone who's bang on.
I would say, no, I've heard that he's unreal. And I was in a lift with him. I got on because, but I just didn't get him that day, but I got everyone else. Don Cheadle, he's the, what's his name?
He is the War Machine.
Yes. And he's lovely and he loves Ireland.
He's in Ocean's 11 as well.
And he was in The Guard with Brendan Gleeson. He loves Ireland.
The American Copper in that. If you ever see him in Ocean's 11, he plays an English fella and it's just stupid because he can't do the accent.
Yeah. But if you find an actor and there's any, even the most tenuous Irish link, you're kind of okay and you just got to like stick to that and hope that the other 10 Irish
people...
And is
that what you've done with him?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you're like, I'm Irish. You were in an Irish film. You met Brendan Gleeson. I met him before. How are you?
Basically, yeah.
Yeah, we're relating now.
Yeah, and they're like, so did the 5 other Irish people tell me that before you.
But I just feel like you don't get a sense for how sound someone could be because you're like, they're being handheld into you and then you have this form in a slot and then they're being took away from you. So it's like, how can they be themselves?
I think if the star is big enough and wants to, like, for example, my first ever interview and I was shitting bricks was Hugh Jackman.
Mm.
And he didn't care about, his PR people being like, oh, you just wait. He's like, I don't care. I'm going to fucking have a chat with someone. He was so nice and so chatty, but I was so nervous. He came out of the room, like into the hallway, and he's like so tall and he's just got a huge presence and he's so nice. And he was like, oh, Caroline, how's it going? In his Australian accent, which I won't attempt to do. but I was so thrown because I was like told, this is exactly how it's going to go. These are your exact minutes. I had my exact question prepared. And then he sits down and he's like, oh, Ireland, you guys are doing really well in the cricket. And I was like, I don't fucking know anything about cricket. I was like, do not go off script. And I must have been like, yeah. Anyway, back to the questions. And I just died. But he was, even though I only had a few minutes, you could tell he just would go out of his way to make you, he was trying to make me feel comfortable. He made me feel massively uncomfortable because I just wasn't ready for like riffing at that point. It was my very first time. It felt like such a huge deal. I was sent over. I was so young. You know, you get on the flight, you had to promote the movie, everyone wanting to watch it back after. And I just was like, so tell me about your movie. Okay, next question.
And would you ever just sit and say to them, look, I'm actually really nervous here. That would be like my go-to with them if I was. Yeah. I'd just be like, look, I'm nervous. Bear with me. Sorry.
Well, there's a guy then who was on the BBC who became famous and his junkets always went viral because he was like, I don't have a clue what I'm doing. And it really worked for him, but it just wouldn't work for everyone, I think.
If you're actually being honest about
it. Yeah.
I don't, like, he probably has it as like a fucking thing.
It's a thing
and he's known for that thing. But if you're actually being honest, probably not in nervous for some interviews, but if you were, say it. Just be like,
I think it depends again though, because you can just, I don't know, you can just read a room.
Yeah.
And like if I had said that to Justin Timberlake, he would have been like, I don't fucking care.
Yeah.
And then you'd feel so much more nervous. Yeah, so sometimes it's like, okay, game face on. And sometimes,
And the heartbreaking to think that, like, John, you think these people are legends and you're like,
yeah.
Oh, that's for you. see you next Tuesday, like, do you know what I mean?
It was rare though that like they were really rude, like
especially Justin Timberlake. Remember, we got
remember,
and it was like if you could hang around with one famous person, who would it be? I was like, Justin Timberlake seems like he's sound.
Yeah, you
did
say that. Yeah.
Do you not read the Britney book?
What?
Do you not read the Britney book? It comes out awful in that.
Yeah, but I feel like any girl would say about their ex.
Anybody can do that about anyone, really. You have to meet someone. That's what I always say.
Yeah,
I did though.
Yeah, well, there you go.
What I'm saying. So now it's valid.
But I believe you, Martin, I believe Britney Spears, even though she was with him. I believe you're forming an interaction more than that.
Yeah, probably, yeah. Oh, God, love Britney.
Remember, she dances with the knives and all, does she?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, her Instagram.
And the comments were like, if you need help, wear a yellow top tomorrow. And then the next video, it's wearing a yellow top and all. And I'm like, what is going on here?
Well, it is believed that she was trying to communicate through her social media because of the, whatever the word
cohesive control thing.
Coercive control.
Coercive.
What's it? No, there's a name for it. That
there is, yeah.
The agreement.
Receivership. No, it's not receivership. No. It's something ship, though.
We just have no words today.
No,
great time.
We all do a podcast, not one of us can talk.
Do you want to see her out there? She was like, I was walking.
Conservator.
I was like, yeah, I was walking.
I got it.
Conservatorship. Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Britney has one, or had one, and so she was trying to communicate through social media. Do you know what? I didn't expect our conversation to go here.
Yeah, neither did I.
Well, here we are.
He's like, who's Britney?
Do you know Britney Spears is?
Or they found the money or something.
That's what we're talking about. Yeah. That's
the fella is educated, kind of learning. What we're talking about. Coercive ship.
We should just ask. We're there clicking and all. We'll be talking about anxiety or something, will we?
Yeah, yeah. No, but Cardinal, do us a favour. Take us back to the start. Tell us how you got to that position where you're talking to all these famous people and then...
Okay, so that, it was actually a really small portion of... It was the very beginning of my working life, my career. And I was actually quite okay at that point. I think I was always an anxious kid, but we never had the language. I never would have labelled myself as anxious. It was just, I just never felt quite at ease. I felt very different to my friends in school who were always like, you know, mad to get as far away from their parents as possible. I was like a sap who just wanted to stay in with my mom and dad all the time. I never felt well. I had like lots of tummy issues, which were now, I understand, mostly anxiety manifesting in a way that like it was, you know, it was presenting as that, but there was no dots connected between my mind and what was going on in my body. But by the time I was in college and out of college and started that job, I was doing quite okay. And I couldn't believe my luck to be working, you know, in interviewing movie stars, to think of how nervous and anxious I had been in my teens, to being able to handle that and do that and, you know, sometimes do an okay job. I was flying high. And then I was young and I was ambitious. I was like in my early 20s and I'd worked my way up from an intern. I kind of basically begged them for a job. They didn't have one. And I was like, let me just find a way to like make myself useful. Eventually, you know, someone left or died or had a baby and I got in. Yeah. And then I worked my way up. And then within a very short time frame, I was the editor of the whole editorial section, which was like, again, it was just a lovely, lovely time in media as well, in Ireland. And then I was like, I need another challenge. And I left a really gorgeous job with sound people where I was challenged in the right way without it being like detrimental. And I just thought, I just had this belief that you have to keep, if you get comfortable, like you'll get stale, or you have to keep pushing, which is, I now I'm like, no, if you're really enjoying yourself, like just, it's okay to just stay put for a while. I was so young. And I went and I got a job in a startup, for a startup media company. And there was all buzz about it at the time. And I was so excited. Maybe it was going to happen to me anyway. Maybe it was always bubbling under the surface, but for whatever reason, almost as soon as I started that job, all my tummy troubles from, I say tummy like I'm seven, stomach issues, started to come back with like a bang. And I was like, I don't feel well. And I just knew in my head there was some link that I didn't want to think about between having started this new job and suddenly not feeling well. And it was very, there was no structure. It was, you know, startup, like we were in the guy's living room. It was nothing to do with the company or what they were doing or anything bad in that environment. I just was like, why the fuck did I leave my job? That was great. And now I've been replaced and I can't go back. And I think it was probably just for me, the catalyst that like I say, I think it was always going to come out of me at some point. The anxiety had to like rise to the surface. So I started to get really unwell, and I got so unwell that I convinced myself. So I'm a Northsider. like you guys. Are you Northsiders?
Yeah.
Okay. And I moved. Well, you could have been in the middle.
I'm actually from Dalkey.
Yeah. Dalkey broke head in us, yeah.
I moved. This is how far gone I was into thinking there must be something wrong with me without ever wanting to admit that it was a mental health problem. I was living with my boyfriend in Milltown and I was like, it must be the South Dublin City tap water making me sick. I know, that's how bad I was. I was convinced, I was Googling it, there must be some different kind of fluoride
I don't
or whatever.
Think that's reaching, I would have been the shame. You'd be questioning everything.
Everything. I convinced myself that I had a cramp one day and I was like Googling it. And of course, if you Google it, it's like you're about to die of cancer tomorrow. I had a brain tumor one day, I had cancer the next day. And I started to just unravel to the point that I was so ill physically, but also mentally. And I remember one day it all just manifested in this massive panic attack. And I was on my way into the office and I got lost. I got off the bus at the wrong place and I just was really disoriented. Even though I've lived in Dublin my whole life, I just didn't know really where I was. And I just felt like I wasn't in control of my body. And it was really frightening. And I remember ringing my mom, who would always be like, get on with it, you're grand, you know, because I was always as a child complaining and not feeling well. When she sounded worried, I was like, maybe I'm not okay. And I remember I was trying to put my mascara on. I'm doing the hand gesture here that morning. And I physically couldn't. You wouldn't know this now, but you know, you have to have a nice steady hand for mascara and eyeliner. I couldn't get it on. I was just all over the place because I was shaking so much. So basically what happened, what I now understand, was something wasn't right. I knew I needed to get out of that situation, but I buried it. I suppressed it. I didn't want to believe. I thought that if I said that out loud, that would mean I was weak and people were handling far more stress and I needed to get a grip and what was wrong with me and oh my God. And it just grew arms and legs until it like radiated out of me. And it was like, I always say my stomach issues was the vehicle through which the anxiety was desperately trying to communicate with me. And when I wasn't paying attention and I wasn't getting the message and I wasn't, you know, making changes, it turned up the volume, like I cranked it up by throwing in really severe panic attacks. And at that point, I hadn't really, I'd experienced anxiety, but it wasn't to the point that I was like, I'm not okay with anxiety right now. That was only when I was in my early to mid 20s that I was like, I think I'm anxious.
You mentioned earlier as well that you feel like you had it even from when you were a kid.
Yeah, I think I always did.
Where do you think that stemmed from?
Well, I'm kind of going through it now with my son, who's 3.5. And I realize now that we all come into the world, and I've had different psychologists help me understand this. We all come into the world with what's known as a window of tolerance. And it's nothing to do with how you're parented. It's nothing to do with, like, it's just your DNA, your temperament, I suppose. And some of us come into the world with a much narrower window of tolerance. And what that means is, if you think about, you know, the game Operation, and you're trying to not bang off the sides.
I hate it.
Gives you anxiety. Yeah. Some kids are born with it. So basically, it doesn't take very much for them to hit off the sides at all. And the alarm goes off and then your body's like, oh, stress, fight or flight mode. Some kids they have much bigger windows of tolerance. So they can experience like change of routine and things. And before they'll start to feel stressed, they have much more wiggle room. So I think I was probably one of those kids who was quite sensitive. I think I'm a highly sensitive person. That's another kind of categorization that people say now. I would have felt everything greatly, like felt good things in a big way and felt bad things in a big way. And I think, and I never want my mom or dad to feel bad about this, because they worked really hard to like provide for us. My dad, they worked shift, and my mom was a travel agent. She was away quite a lot. And I just really, really missed my mom. And I think I really needed her. And I think because I can see it now from my son's perspective and how he has struggled with separation anxiety, and society kind of tells us, oh, they have to get on with it, they have to grow thick skin, you have to go to work. And I kind of changed that and was like, I actually think he just really needs me at the moment, and maybe it's okay if I give that to him. So it's made me go back in time and be like, I remember like the happiest days of my life in primary school was on a Wednesday. For a period of time, my mom worked it so that she could take a half day, and she'd pick me up and she'd have warm bread rolls from Spar and we'd go home, and it was like the most at ease I'd ever been. So I think kids just maybe need a bit more of that, and I was one of those kids, but society did not really support that or allow for that at that point. And so I think there was elements there of, I was probably just an anxiously natured kid.
And would you have just been like labelled as like shy?
I wasn't shy. No, I just, the label was, she has a dicky tummy.
Right.
But I remember, I have such vivid memories of being left at like my grandparents' house and my parents having to go away, whatever, and just feeling like, I don't feel well. And that was my body being like, we don't like this, this trigger. And then when I was, I feel like there's a bit of a turning point. And again, I've understood this more as I've gotten older and I had to understand anxiety. But until you're about 7 or 8, up until that point, you can develop a really strong fear response. You can have, you know, nightmares are really hard for kids, but you have not yet developed the part of your brain that can help to reason and rationalize and like say, no, you're actually okay. So those ages, like 6, 7, 8, are really delicate, the informative years for a kid. So if you have what might seem trivial to an adult, but for a kid, if it's a traumatic experience, it can kind of lock in this little fear memory. And if it's not dealt with or addressed properly, it can come back as anxiety later on. So for me, there's a couple of things that I remember vividly, and it was my grandparents all died within a really short space of time. And again, that was probably taking my parents away from me a bit more because they were dealing with that. But I remember being brought to see my granddad in the morgue, and you know, I don't blame my parents for this at all, because it was just, I guess, try to help me say goodbye. And but I saw him, and the coffin had broken his nose, so my granddad's face, I'm looking at a corpse and his face is smashed in. And I remember from then on after, like, I don't even think I was able to articulate that, why that was scary, but I had to sleep. I begged my brother, who's 6 years older than me, every night for I don't know how long, could I please sleep in the room with him? And he was, so I was 7, he was, what's 7 plus 6? And he's like, get away from me. He used to call me a disease. Get away from me, you disease. And I still remember this visual I had, this fear. I used to like stare at his wardrobe when he would finally relent and let me in. And I could just imagine that my granddad was a ghost or something on top of the wardrobe. Because your parents would say, your nana's always with you. I don't fucking want her to be with me. She's fucking dead. I don't, that scared the shit out of me.
Yeah.
So I remember before my granddad had died, being brought to my granddad's house, but my nana had already died. And it was like, go on upstairs now and do your teeth and put on your jammies. I was like, are you joking? I have to go upstairs on my own in a house that I don't really stay in all that often. And my nana is with me and she could be wandering around in a ghost with chains hanging off her. And I still remember the feeling of shaking and feeling sick, because now these days, if I feel anxious, it just goes straight to my mind and I can say it and I can articulate it. But as a kid, it can. So some people can feel headaches, whatever. Kids really typically present with stomach issues. So I kind of now go back, and while I always would have said I'd really, like, I did have a really normal, privileged upbringing, there was always a level of anxiety at play. And it was probably always going to come out. And then unfortunately, it was just this job, this change. At the same time, I moved out of my family home. Like I said, I was super attached and super needy for them. And my favorite thing, I had the most unbelievable DVD collection because I just had no life. I just didn't want to go out ever. My favorite thing was if my dad said, come on, we put on a movie and I light the fire. And that was just like heaven to me. When my peers were like, Scarlet, for you, like, we want to go away, we want to go on. I didn't go on a 6-year trip. I didn't do, and I felt like such, I couldn't confront at the time, but I felt so different. And I think I just would have internalized that and been like, grip, like, you're a loser. Why don't you want to go out clubbing? Why don't you want to go drinking? And I was so afraid to feel unwell away from home. So yeah, it was always probably there, 100%.
For cutting across that. See, when you mentioned a child being about 6, 7, 8, and some of these like traumatic experiences and the lodging in their brain, they can't rationalize it. When can you like?
So I should have included this. It's about the age of 12 when they start. There's some other, I'm not 100% sure in this, another part of the brain starts to kind of turn on then, and that's when you're coming into adolescence. So within those years of like maybe 6, 7 and 11, 12, they're like delicate years, I think. But really the prefrontal cortex, which is the more formative, the more frontal part of our brain, which
21
is
21 or something, isn't it?
That's 25.
25, is it? Yeah.
And that is the part that's like the executive function. That's the CEO of your brain. That's the part that when you're feeling well and strong can say, no, we don't need to worry about this. Or yes, let's look at the facts. We don't have that as kids or teenagers. And also as adults then, so the amygdala, which is the part of the brain, like, I'm not a scientist, I'm not a doctor, but
You've done your homework.
Well, I had to, because I just was so desperate to understand why I wasn't okay. And why I just, because everyone's like, what's wrong with you? You've no reason to fall apart. You've no reason to be anxious. You know, you look fine. You've got a great life. And on paper I did, but I was like, I'm not okay. And this terrifies me. But what happened was, because I ignored what was going on in that job and I just ignored the stress, which started off probably just a stress that I could have solved. It went on and on and on. And eventually the amygdala, which is the part of your brain that's triggering those, that fear response, that like essentially hijacks the prefrontal cortex and takes over, and it's firing off left, right and center. Your prefrontal cortex is completely worn out. It's not at work. It's not able to do its job. And then you're reacting to things like being, feeling overwhelmed by loud noises on a bus or feeling like disoriented, having this anxious response to things that normally wouldn't trigger you. Like I remember having in that time, having a panic attack at like a deli queue. Now I still wouldn't like being at a queue and having to order when you're at the till. I don't like that. But it was these things that seemed innocuous or seemed trivial to someone else. And I just would, and it really frightened me because I didn't understand it at all. So I eventually quit the job because it was really hard to do because, you know, I had, like I said, I just moved out. I had bills to pay. Still thought it was the Dublin City Water. It wasn't. And I just felt like I couldn't admit, it was admitting weakness, admitting failure. And I had to go on like sickness benefit. And my boyfriend, we had moved in together really quickly. And I went from being like super carefree, but like, right, I'm off to interview Johnny Depp, to being like, I can't leave the house. I couldn't leave the apartment. So I was on my own all day, every day, because he had to go to work, just getting my sickness benefit into my account and being like, I have no idea how I'm going to get back to some semblance of normality.
And are you trying to get diagnosed? Like, are you going? Are you seeing medical professionals?
Yeah, I went to doctors. I went to GPs because it was so physical for me at the time. I still needed to rule out. And I would always recommend this to someone who has such severe anxiety, like rule out the physical stuff first, because a lot of people can suffer from a thyroid issue and that can present as anxiety. So you want to get a good, clean bill of physical health so that you can then say, right, I know it's what I'm dealing with. Yeah, because you don't want to be chasing down things. Like another thing from when I was growing up, even though I blame anxiety, I didn't feel well a lot of the time because I had lactose intolerance, but I didn't know it.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time we can over blame anxiety when there might be something that's contributing and you need to know both. So I would always go at it like holistically, in physically and the emotional side. But I went to doctors and even the GPs I went to, they just weren't adept. They weren't good enough to say, yeah, that makes sense. I understand. She looked at me like I had two heads and I was like, I think I need medication. I think I need help. And I felt infinitely worse coming out of doctors being like, the people who are supposed to help me are looking at me like they were afraid of me, like it was contagious or something. Eventually I went to therapy and I was doing talking therapy. And at the time, it just, that wasn't they call it like a modality, like different types. It wasn't the modality that suited me. I didn't need to keep talking around and around in circles about how bad I was feeling. I knew I was feeling bad. I needed something that was more practical. So then when I started doing CBT, which is cognitive behavioral therapy, with a really good therapist who didn't make me feel like a lunatic, I was starting to put, you know, things in place. And I started off with like experiments, like really basic things like saying, right, I'm going to go to the shop and I'm going to allow myself to feel anxious there. And I'm going to just, you know, and I can leave if I want and I can, you know, stuff like that and report back. So I was gathering data and I was like, what might I feel? How did it go? What did I feel after? And it's kind of what I'm doing with my son now to a much more extreme degree because he's so young. And that's another, a whole other conversation is people saying, yeah, he's probably just got all that from you. Yeah, the most horizontal person ever. So I had to start from scratch and then get myself back to here. And then because I was writing, I was a journalist, I had been editing and writing, I eventually got a job in a magazine and I went in there and I, you know, I would have thought at the time you'd have to go in and be like, I am incredible, here is all my skills. I went in and I said, I am not okay, like I'm really struggling, I'm recovering from something, I don't want to be front and center like at events, but I am really good at my job and if you just let me kind of sit back and do the work, I will produce the work for you. And they responded to me it was the biggest relief to be like, it's, so you know, you can be professional and not be okay at the same time. Like I just had to put my hand up and say, not right now, this is not my time to push, but I can run a website, I can create content, I can manage all that stuff. And I had to kind of take a step back. So I was editor and then I had to go back to being a deputy editor. And I was delighted with that because I just wanted time to just like settle and get better. And then when I got my confidence back, and I mean, it was really a year and a half of going from crippling anxiety I remember one Christmas and New Year's and I was still probably in denial quite a bit, but having my friends were down and we were out all the time, I was like taking about 3 Valium a day, and I was so anxious that that wasn't even making me sleepy or out of it, because it was taking me from the roof down to normality, as opposed to if you're at normal level and then you take one, you might be like sleepy. I went on medication and I felt massive shame around that, because it wasn't spoken about. Like at that time, or this is 2014, 10 years ago, you were only going on social media to post your bikini pictures from Bali.
Yeah.
You weren't showing vulnerability. You were putting your best foot forward. It was kind of toxic, really. And I felt like there's no space for me. I won't be welcome. You know, who wants to hear this? I had so much shame about myself that I couldn't, because I was like having a very privileged existence, yet I was falling apart. And this whole thing of, you have everything going for you. And like, I don't know why I'm feeling this way, but actually anxiety doesn't care that I have a roof over my head, or depression doesn't care. It's just my body has unraveled into this state over time, and it's, I can't just have a cup of tea and have a chat and it be gone. It was going to take me longer to get back to, for my, that amygdala part of my brain to trust that I'm safe and calm down.
Sorry, when you said you took your first panic attack, did you know you were taking a panic attack?
Not at the time, no. No, I didn't really understand it then. And then it was my boyfriend, who's now my husband, in fairness to him, because he was really trying to help. He was Googling everything. He had the brain space, or he was, you know, functioning enough to be able to read things. And I would have just taken something and gone off the deep end. So he was able to say, like, he actually kind of helped me understand it a bit more. But I really had to teach myself everything and start from scratch. And then once I had like one or two panic attacks, I kind of knew what they were. And then, but they were, again, they didn't discriminate. They could happen if I'm just sitting on the couch, and they did. And it was so frightening, because it wasn't like I was anxious about a certain thing. Like, it wasn't like going on a plane. It wasn't a phobia. It was an anxiety that pervaded every part of my being, every fiber of my being. It was just with me, and it wasn't tangible. I couldn't put my finger on it and say, that's what I'm anxious about. I was frightened of myself. I was terrified that I was capable of falling apart. I was terrified that I might not ever be okay again. The biggest fear, one of the biggest fears humans have, is the fear of losing their mind. But apparently if you have that fear, you're not losing your mind.
Yeah, because you're aware.
I'm so glad you're saying that, because I have a couple of, I'm privileged enough, I think I've took a handful of panic attacks in my whole entire life. I don't suffer with panic attacks, but I have actually know a good few people close to me who are still suffering with panic attacks now, and that is a common thing what they say to me. Like, if somebody close to me said to me only a couple of months ago, maybe 2 or 3 months ago, when I was talking to him, said that they took a panic attack that morning, and said them exact words, I think I'm losing my mind.
Yeah, it's a fear. It's a really innate fear that we have, and that we'll just go crazy, you know. And I remember, like, we lived in Milltown, and there was the mental hospital on the Dundrum Road, and I actually would drive out of my way to avoid it, because I was so frightened that I would end up there. And I know that's contributing to the stigma as well, because it's okay if you end up there, you might just need a break and help and support. But at the time, I didn't know enough. It was still, there was such a stigma, and I was part of that, but I was frightened of myself. But I remember sitting on a couch, and like, if my mind was idle in any way, it's like a vacuum, the anxiety would just come in and fill it, and all it would take would be like a thought, like, what if you're never okay, what if this happens? And it was like a bomb going off in my head, and a physical feeling of fire spreading from my chest outwards. And it's not that I was, you know, having palpitations into a brown paper bag, you wouldn't necessarily have known, but it was just this, I guess on the inside, it was the adrenaline and the cortisol just flooding my body, yet I had nothing to run away from, like setting you up for fight or flight, but nothing to fight and nothing to flee from.
That's what I wanted to ask you, Carolyn. What do you think, what would your definition of anxiety be? Because everyone's like, gets like, I think it's thrown around so much.
It is,
like,
yeah.
But like in a humorous way, like, you know what I mean? Like, oh, like,
that's because of my anxiety.
Yeah, will you fix that and get anxious over this? Oh, look at this, that's giving me anxiety. You know, like stuff like that, and that's grand, but what I think the downside to that is people have different definitions and what it means to different people then. So it makes it hard for other people to understand somebody who's actually suffering from it. Like, how do you get anxiety from that when, like, I get anxiety when my pillows aren't straight on my bed? Yeah. How are you having a panic attack?
Yeah, you know? I think the language has, in one way, it's been great that people are familiar with it and it's normalized. But in another way, it's so easy to conflate just a shit day with having anxiety. And I think there's a spectrum of, you know, stress, overwhelm, and then yes, anxiety is what happens when our body gets flooded with these hormones in a moment, like when you're supposed to have anxiety, like if you step out onto the road and a car is coming and you get that flood, that's you know, so important to have. We never want to turn that part of us off. It's so integral for our survival.
Instinct, you need
it's
that.
It's instinct.
Yeah.
What happens when to me, what anxiety was staying in that fight or flight mode when there's no threat.
Yeah.
So perceiving threats that weren't there, real or imagined, because your brain can't tell the difference between a real or imagined threat. So if you're vulnerable enough and thinking enough, what if this happens? Your brain is like, well, it's obviously already happening. Mm. And even to this day, if I think, it's fine when I'm in this environment, but if I was to be feeling a little bit vulnerable or stressed out or a little bit run down, and I start to think about, God, remember how bad you were? What if that happened again? It could go off at me like a bomb.
Yeah.
But now I know, okay, that's okay if that happens. That's actually a trauma response from what happened. And we know what to do now. We know you'll come out of it again. So I started to realize anxiety was, you know, to me, it was when it's in the way of your day-to-day life and it's chronic and you can't, it's not about something you could put your finger on. I was ill. Like I was physically and mentally unwell with anxiety. I think people say, oh, you're an anxious person. That could be just a worrier or someone who tends to catastrophize. But I felt like I was suffering from anxiety as opposed to it's just my personality, if that makes sense.
So obviously you're suffering this for years and it seems like you're coming around to kind of taking ownership over it now. Where does that come to a head? You say, right now, I'm getting out there. I'm going to understand what's happening.
I felt like I had no choice but to. And I think for me, because I was writing, so when I was in Image magazine, which was where I was like hibernating while I got better, I started writing articles about anxiety because I knew, I was still in the depths of it, there was so much bullshit out there that preys on people's vulnerability. And, you know, I would go online and be like, suffering from anxiety. And it was like, just give us your PPS number there and we'll unlock the secret for you and you'll never have a panic attack again. Or here's your bank, give us your bank details. And I was like signing up for God knows what. And I would do these things and I would go to these sessions, these therapy things that said you just need one session. They just tape something to my head. And I honestly was like, great, I'm going to come out of here. And as if it was like a virus that I needed to get rid of. That's because I didn't understand it. So I was thinking of people in a similar boat who were just vulnerable, who would throw, you throw money at it because you're just like, I just want to feel better. Yeah. But it doesn't work that way. You can't just go in and have that happen to you. And I remember going to one thing, I begged my mom to take me to this guy down the country. And it was, again, it was like one session and you'll be cured. And if I will run a mile from anyone who says that bullshit now on my podcast. I've done podcasts with people who do that, and I'm like, I'm not putting that out there because I have to protect people because I was that person. And I came out of the session being like, I actually think I'm cured, like I feel fine. And I was like on cloud nine. And I remember later on, the day went on, and my mom and dad as well, because they didn't understand. They're like, so you're fine now? Yeah. I was like, yeah, I'm actually grand. It's like, okay, right, I'm gonna go to bed. And I was lying in bed, I was like, I am, yeah, I think I'm fine. Am I fine? Just feel a little bit of a wave there. And then it just snowballed. I was like, you're not fine. Oh my God, you're not better. You are broken. You cannot be fixed. Oh my God.
Yeah,
he promised you.
It made it worse, yeah. Because like, this is supposed to fix you.
It made
me your bollocks.
So much worse.
Yeah.
So when I was in a position to be able to write about it and have an audience there and a platform like the magazines and online, I was like, people need to know about this. I can't be the only person. So I wrote a couple of things when I was in Image. And then when I was okay enough to, I went freelance and I've never had a normal job since. I've been on my own since then. That was 2016. I wrote an article for the Irish Times. I was writing for their health supplement and it was a very step-by-step, like 10 points of, if you start to suffer with anxiety and you really don't know what to do, start here, go here, try this, rule this out first, consider this, remember this, know this. And it did really well. And then a publisher obviously found it and got on to me and said, this could be a book. And I said, do you have the wrong email? And I couldn't believe it. I was like, well, I actually have anxiety, but okay, give me some more while you're at it. And then I wrote it and it came out of me so easily because I knew at that point so much about it. That was my strength, was being able, and that's still my strength, to be able to say, here's a problem. I'm going to understand this inside out. So that's what I'm doing now for my son, like no stone unturned to help me help him, because I had to do that for myself. And then I felt this desire and this obligation to share that with people. But not only was it people say, oh, like, oh, you're, you know, it's brave of you to share. I've never felt like I like, you can't shut me up here. I can't not do that. It's a coping strategy of mine to be like, hey, I'm feeling this way. Are you also feeling, is anyone else feeling this way? It was to the point that I could probably do with sharing less. But I, for me, I've always just, I wanted so much to be validated and heard and understood so that the child version of me could be like, no, you were right to feel that way. That was okay that you felt that way. When the world is like, get on with it.
I think that's a common thing though, what you're saying, when you feel obligated. I think that's a common thing in so many different areas in life. So like, you're like that with anxiety, and I think people who are in recovery from drinking drugs like to deal with that, and people who are going into fitness, when
it's
they
motivating.
Go into it and they experience it and they see like things get better, it's just like you want to put it out there.
Yeah.
And keep telling people that there's a light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah,
absolutely. And I really, because I just kept thinking about myself, even like at the time, I was only 3 years into it, you know, and to this day, there's people who, especially like after COVID, had never had a flutter of anxiety before, suddenly were like, why am I feeling this way? And it's, there's nothing scarier than starting to feel it, but thinking you're like impervious to it, and but then also not understanding it and not being around people who are supportive or open-minded. Because a lot of people, like a lot of my friends, families would be like, mental health is not a thing.
Yeah.
Do you know, like, and if you're in that environment, just going to grow arms and legs, that is, you know, toxic. So I feel as passionate today to help people understand. And if they can understand through my experience, which is a very ordinary experience, like, nothing that bad happened to me. I didn't, there's no traumatic story. There's no big thing to say. I just started to unravel because I was vulnerable. My mental health wasn't in great shape. I didn't understand it. And it took me a long time to get there and put the pieces back together again.
I think that makes it worse though, because there's no pinpoint thing. It's not like, oh, this traumatic event happened to you. That's why you don't feel great. That's why you suffer anxiety. It's just like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Like, where did this come from? And that makes it 10 times
100%.
Worse, because you're like, there is no clear and obvious point in time that you can point to.
Yeah. And we were saying this like off mic. But I definitely think there's this, we still struggle with this idea of when it's your mental health, you know, and it's your mind, and up in your mind is where you think and talk and ideas come. We feel like our mental health or our brain, that is us, whereas our body is kind of separate to us. So if when it's like a broken arm, we're like, oh, my, like, it's not me, it's my arm. And there's still this idea of, well, if it's my mind, I should be in control of it. And if I'm not, that's back to one of our most innate human fears. So when we can try to understand it in the context of our body and what's happening on a hormonal level. So like when I brought it down to, you are flooded with cortisol right now. So no matter what anyone says to you, it doesn't make a difference. We need to try and dampen that down. And that's going to take time. Until I could understand that, or if I went into a wave of anxiety, which I started to describe them as waves, and then I realized, oh, I'm anxious. It didn't just make it stop then just because I was cognitively aware of it. I had to let it, all those hormones, run their course. And eventually I learned that when I was in an anxious wave, I could not trust whatever my mind was telling me in that moment. It was like anxiety goggles, because I was seeing and perceiving the world through this lens of my amygdala and feeling threats that weren't there. And I started to realize, I won't feel this way about this thing that's coming up in a few days' time. So I had to the more anxious I felt, the more experience I had, the more data I had to be able to say, well, what happened last time? What do we know now that we didn't know then? So it made me be less fearful of feeling anxious, because every time I would have a panic attack, I'd have something new that I'd learn, or I'd know that I actually got over that the last time. So they became fewer and further between, less intense, to the point that, well, I don't know when I last had a panic attack. I never want to measure my success as how long it's been since my panic attack, because they happen. And I understand if they happen, why. What I can tease it apart. It's never a nice feeling, but I think fearing the anxiety was the place I was stuck in for a long time. And that's, you have to try and not be afraid of it.
It sounds like you're getting your expertise from like learned experiences there. So I know how to tackle the panic attack now because I've been through so many of them. But obviously from what you're saying and the details I've given, it's obviously not from learned experience, because you have so much level of knowledge. Where did that come from?
Well, when I was writing the book, obviously I had to draw from my own experience, but I couldn't share any advice because I can't, not as a medical professional, say, do this, do that. I could only say, this is what worked for me. So I had to bring in loads of different experts to kind of back up what I was saying and validate it and give this science of it, the likes of Brian Penny, who you've had on the podcast. So through interviewing countless, you know, I've Stanford's like my celeb, you were talking about celebs, but the people I get excited about having on my podcast are like nerds, like Stanford psychiatrists, TED talking, you know, really into that science. And it's, to me, it's just amazing. But I suppose I learned a lot from speaking to those people, from doing research, from digging in, because I couldn't rely on my own experience in the book. I could never just write from my own perspective. I had to rely on every other expert to underpin it, to give it weight and to give it that gravitas, I suppose. Otherwise, it would just be like a memoir. And who was I? No one cares. Like, you know, it had to be, there had to be more to it. So that's why I think I know as much as I know now. But it's really validating when I do speak to an expert, like, a, you know, someone really high up in some psychological department, and they're like, yeah, that's right. Yeah, you explained that well. And I'm like, yes.
Yeah.
But I don't think I'll necessarily go back and do all of the education required to get the piece of paper to validate what I already know. I think it's just useful for me.
Just to cope with it. Yeah. I think it's very important what you're saying there about, like, your mind and your body, mm-hmm. like, not being a separate thing. Like, your mind is you and your body is your vessel or whatever. It's like, we are, like, you are all one entity. Like, if you put your hand on something and it was hot, you will move your hand back. But then there's things like in your body that you can't control. So, like, we were talking about when you're nervous, you shake. Yeah, you can't actually, like, that's not you shaking. Your body's just doing that. And then when you're scared, you get goosebumps. Mm-hmm. But, like, that's a primal thing. That's to make you look bigger, because we used to be dealing with predators or whatever. But there is things that your body's doing that you need to learn how to take control over. And what we don't, it sounds very holistic when you're like, oh, you're all one, and your mind can, like, mm-hmm. stress can lead to, like, illnesses, and people don't really, I don't think enough people realise this. And, like, you're giving an example of you had problems with your stomach, but that was, like, kind of self-inflicted problems.
Yeah.
And you're there looking at external factors, you're like, I'm drinking the wrong water and all, but it's all happening internally in your mind, mm-hmm. that if you learn how to cope with that, your health starts to increase then, and then you're more mindful as well, so, like, your lifestyle will actually start to see the benefit of that as well.
Yeah.
I know you did say, you literally just finished there saying you're not an expert, but what tips would you give somebody to who is struggling, who is feeling anxious, who is, I don't know. Another example is if you're run down, you get cold sores. Like, that's your body's response to, like, stress.
No, I have so much advice, but I guess I just always caveat it. I don't want someone coming for me saying, who are you to say that?
Yeah.
But so I can draw from my own experience, but for me, I guess the most important things are taking the time to educate yourself and understand what's happening. So in my first book, when it came out, I did not expect it to do so well. And it, because so many people were struggling but not talking about it, so it was just the right time. I came up with this technique, called the assess and address technique. And it was a framework, I suppose, I retrofitted to how I managed everything. So assess was to understand, okay, well, what is anxiety? What happens in our bodies? Why do we feel anxiety? What's the role of anxiety? Then why is this happening for me? What's going on in my life right now? What's been preceding this? Because oftentimes, like you say, when you get run down, you get a cold sore, that happens like at Christmas when you finally switch off and you have time and you get sick. So sometimes, or if you've been through a traumatic experience, your body has got your back and you're coping as it's happening and you're like, I'm actually fine. Months later, when a space opens up and you relax a bit, all comes in and it has to be processed. And you're like, but I was fine then. Why am I not now? So trying to get a real clear picture of, is there something going on here that maybe I'm not aware of? Is there, because we tend to diminish our experience so much and say, no, I was fine. I'm fine. I should be okay. I have X, Y, and Z. I'm privileged. I'm this, I'm that. Like we said, your body doesn't, the stress hormones don't know. They don't care. You are just as vulnerable to that unraveling as anyone. So it's really important then. So the assess, So like, what's going on? What is anxiety? Why am I feeling it? And then address. Okay, now I understand it. What am I going to do about it? Because people go straight to the address part. They go, make this go away. What can I do? Who can I go to? And if you don't first take the time to understand it, there's no point. It's like slapping a plaster on. Like it will come back to bite you in the arse. It won't, you know, you might, like, you'll be like me coming out of that therapy session thinking I'm fixed, and then a little niggle and you'll be gone. So assess and then address. Address is different for everyone. For me, I had tried so many different things. I'd done so many different types of therapy. It's really whatever it is for you that helps your body get into a state of deep relaxation. And for some, that could be acupuncture. For another person, that could be like a fitness class or a swim. It actually doesn't really matter. I spent so long trying to figure out, like, why would this particular thing help? If it works for you and it relaxes you and your body goes into the rest and digest mode and it calms down that cortisol for long enough that your body can just get a little respite from that, and you can, and it's safe and legal and healthy, and you can do that for long enough, then it is a case of whatever works for you. So for me, I had to address the physical side, but also the psychological side. I had to put in place coping strategies and things. So the CBT, the cognitive behavioral therapy, was really a game changer for me. I did a lot of acupuncture. I don't necessarily credit the needles as doing anything other than it was a really relaxing experience. And I never felt anxious in there. It was just, I felt safe and warm and relaxed. And like, I could have just been listening to a podcast and had the same effect. I went on medication because it was so severe for me. And I kind of see them as like spokes on a wheel. And so for you, it might be running. For me, when I remember going running when I was really bad, thinking that would help, I felt so much worse. And it really does depend on the type of exercise you do is important, because for me, running actually produces like a bit more cortisol. It kind of, it's a stressful exercise on your body. And I was like, why am I feeling so panicked after this? So running was actually the worst thing I could have done. So when I changed to doing more like weight training, resistance training, it was actually more soothing to the hormones. So you really have to get into understanding, what am I doing? Am I adding fuel to the fire, or am I calming things down?
Yeah, it's such a unique thing.
It is. And it's trial and error. So for me, it was physical, like, so somatic movement, which I'm only kind of learning more about now. But like, we talk about being in fight or flight and, you know, the goosebumps. Your body is preparing to do something. That energy needs to go somewhere. So sometimes it was as simple as I just did like a video yoga class every morning just to stretch my body. My morning anxiety was the worst. And that's because in the morning you wake up and we produce this extra dose of cortisol to wake us up, to get us ready for the day. And we've done that since primitive times. If you're already anxious and stressed out of your mind, you already like have enough cortisol in your body. You're up here, and then you get this spike in the morning and you're like, oh my God, what is this? And it was awful. And I didn't get it for so long until I read about it. And I would have thought, just want to stay in bed, just want to stay under the covers. I had aches and pains all over my body. It was just like, I would describe it as like crystallizing in my limbs. It was really bad. But then I learned, actually, the quicker you get out of bed and get warm water in the shower and start moving, it starts to loosen out, starts to move out. So like those things I learned, and that was about movement. So addressing the psychological side with therapy, maybe there's reasons for anxiety there that you don't think are there. Maybe someone can help you unpack that. Maybe it's a traumatic experience from years ago. Maybe it's just a simple case of too much change too soon. Maybe you're under the weather. Do the physical thing of ruling out things like, like for women, we could be more prone to anxiety around like your period, or it could be when you're under the weather. Like all these vulnerability factors can create this picture of anxiety. So you have to become aware of them, what it is for you that might be contributing to this. And it doesn't matter if someone else is in a worse situation and handling things better, because that's not your body and that's not your set of circumstances.
And it's like dealing with all anxiety the same. So you're mentioning that you don't have this traumatic event that you can look to and say, that's the reason why I am the way I am. Is dealing with all anxiety the same? Like, let's say somebody who does have usually traumatic experiences in their childhood and now they're dealing with anxiety. Is the all anxiety the same?
I think how it shows up in the body or what's going on like with the physical anxiety in your body, the hormones are all like, it's not like someone's producing cortisol and someone else is producing something completely different, I think. But the therapeutic approach will differ. So like what's really common with a really big trauma would be hypnotherapy. And I actually did a podcast recently. I would have thought before, like, that's a load of bollocks. And I did it with a guy who's another, like, a Harvard psychiatrist. And he made such a convincing case for the science of it. And to me, it makes so much sense for unlocking a traumatic experience and letting that go. It's a really, really worthy thing to try, provided you go to someone reputable. And for someone who really doesn't understand why they're anxious, just regular talking therapy could be really helpful. But for me, I got to the point where I really knew what was going on. I didn't need someone to tell me that I was anxious. I knew that. I knew why I needed to help get past it. I needed proactivity. So what you do, I think, will differ. And I think the right therapist will, because that's another thing. It's so hard to find a therapist. Like, you're just looking from a list. How can you know? It's like you're speed dating and then you don't want to let them down and you want them to like you, and it's awkward. But the right therapist will be like, I'm not a fit for you, or I think you'd benefit more from this. And also a good therapist will draw from different things. So like, you know, you might do a bit of talking therapy. They might bring in elements of CBT. But it is, I mean, I know all of that sounds so overwhelming, but it's like just putting together that wheel and all those spokes on the wheel of what it is for you might just be two or three things. And also, I was only as bad as I was because it was so long building in my system. And yeah. We didn't have the conversations we're having now. I think if anyone felt like that now, they'd be like, say to their friends, I'm feeling a bit anxious. And their friends wouldn't be like, what?
Yeah.
You know, they'd be like, oh yeah, okay, I've heard of that.
You kind of brushed past the fact that you got the book, you wrote it and released, and it was a bestseller.
Yeah.
Right. How does that affect you then? Do you get this sense of like, oh, I must know what I'm talking about then? Does that help you then cope with your anxiety more going forward?
Or did it make you feel vulnerable? Because that could go either way, couldn't it?
Yeah, it could. I think the more followers that I got on social media, the more anxious I have been probably in terms of like people's opinions and taking things you say out of context and just not liking you because they don't know you. And
I actually seen that you done a thing saying that there's people hate following you.
I think everyone who's over a certain number of followers, people are just will just follow to see you trip up.
Yeah.
And I would have been like, because I say like I'm such an open book, I'd be very trusting of people, and I think I go on and I talk and I share in a safe space, but it's not a safe space. Like the internet's the wild, wild west. And it unfortunately is a part of it that people want to take what you say and, you know, and it could be jealousy, it could be they just don't like the look of you, you know, whatever. And I have struggled with that because that's another, like, you know, primal thing of needing to be or wanting to be liked to like safeguard our survival. So that element has been probably a bit more anxiety inducing. Like I actually would not like to get any more followers because I don't want, like, if I was over hundreds of thousands, I think I would find it hard to share because I feel you are literally as vulnerable as exposing yourself to this many opinions. We were never meant to have access to that many opinions. It's not normal and that many people weighing in. But when it came to the books, I think anyone who bought the book were kind about it. Like if they reached out to me about it, they were kind. People were nice about it. Because it did so well, the publishers were like, well, we're obviously doing a second one. And I was asked to go on TV and, you know, radio and all these things. But I was like, did you not fucking read the book?
Life went full circle then. You were on the other side of the interview.
Yeah, exactly. So I remember like my first time on Ireland AM, where I was on with Ryan Tuberty. And that was my first, even though I had been sitting across from these massive superstars, I'd plummeted to such depths that like, I was pumping the Xanax. I was just so riddled with anxiety. And now, like, I do it in my sleep because I've done so much of it. And that's another kind of really good thing of, like, learning the value of exposure therapy. And the more we do in a safe way, the more that our threat system will be like, oh, we did this before, we were safe. We could probably send the troops home. You know, it's fine. So I was anxious about, like, I had to do a lot of public speaking. I didn't have to, but I wanted to, because when I had gotten myself from a point of, you know, not just surviving. Well, I didn't have any quality of life. And then after the first book, it was like, right, I've gotten myself back on my two feet. Now the second book was going to be about going from, you know, surviving to maybe thriving. Like we're back in the world again now. How can we build on that? Confidence was a thing I had to work on then. So the book mirrored where I was anyway, and going and giving these talks, and I was like, I would like to be able to do that and not shit myself and be so riddled with fear. The first few times, like, I was rattled. And then you just find your little ways. I've like loads of coping strategies now for public speaking, and
sent them on to us, will it? Fucking hell.
Can you give us one or two just examples of what? Because I've seen people give great presentations in like a corporate setting, and they pulled me and said they'd done the Superman pose in the mirror before it, and that really benefited them. And I was like, that's so cheesy, but look, if it works for you, it works for you.
When it comes to public speaking, I really allow for my worries. And I think I'm really grateful in some ways that I'm a worrier. Like, for example, with my son right now, if I wasn't worried about him, I wouldn't have kind of sought support and help and things that might help him. If you don't worry, you don't like confront any problems. So in some ways, worrying is useful. So when it comes to being worried about going and doing public speaking, I'd be like, right, let's troubleshoot this. What is the worst possible thing that could go wrong? And I might write it down and be like, you could fall flat on your face. What happens if that happens?
This is literally us.
So when we do live podcasts and Terence is always a bag of nerves.
And the warrior.
You're going to be on my podcast.
That question is always put out, what's the worst that can happen? And Terence's answer is always, what if I fall? Walking on
what
the
if?
Stage.
Like, your biggest fear, again, it probably is that like people will think you're crazy or that you'll lose your mind or you'll just stop functioning. Like, realistically, it's not going to happen. What if I say something terrible or people think I'm stupid? Like, I'm probably never going to see them again. Or, you know, so because you think of what could happen, you kind of plan for it happening. And so even if you're thinking of what if I fall over, you know, make sure you go 5 minutes beforehand and check for rogue wires that you might trip over. I would always ask the question, am I going to be doing a handheld mic or am I going to have a headset or do I need a mic at all? Because I want to have my notes with me. And if I can't have my notes, I will be a bag of nerves. And my notes are there. Like, I actually write out almost everything that I plan to say. I don't use them, like, I don't read from it word for word. But if I don't write it down, I don't feel confident enough. So they're just there as a guide. Mm. And I used to feel like I have to get to a point where I can just write down a bullet point. And no, I don't have to get to that point because what I do works for me. And then once I'm at ease, I'm barely referring to them at all. And then I'm comfortable enough to go off on tangents. Another thing I do is, yeah, so what could possibly go wrong? Practical things like that. What else is there? Looking at past evidence, I suppose. This is relevant to, we were saying this earlier. Because of the nature of what I'm talking about, it's very easy for me to go in and say, well, this is ironic that I'm here talking about anxiety and this is an anxious situation. I like to put people at ease by addressing the fact that it's not a normal situation. I'll make light of it in some way. I know that's not easy for everyone to do. Like, if you're a solicitor, you can't be like, oh, I'm shitting myself going into court. Mm. Do you know?
That's literally what I do. That's me opening live for every live show as well.
Yeah.
Now, it's very simple.
He likes to lower the bar now and be like,
but you have to think about the fact that people are not there necessarily. Well, some might be, but people are intimidated by the fact that you're up on a stage with a microphone. So when you can disarm them, that disarms you. And it's kind of a reciprocal thing.
Yeah.
That's the way, but this, now, obviously not in that depth, but I found from the very first show that I came out and everyone was like, just don't, like people are saying to me, just don't show you're nervous or say you're nervous or anything, just do your thing and you'll be grand. And when I got out on the stage, I naturally just told everyone, I was just like, my nerves are fucking gone. And they all laughed,
but
thinking
then,
it was a joke.
They can relate to you then. And they're like, oh, it's just like me.
Oh, that worked. So I think every show I've opened up with that, haven't I? Like,
yeah, but I bet you it works for you though.
Yeah, it does.
It probably relaxes the audience and that relaxes everyone. You know, if you come on and you're like, I'm the fucking dog's bollocks.
Yeah, I'm all confident, blah, blah, blah.
It's like, well, there's a gap then between how you're feeling and what you're putting out there. And that's going to show up. That's going to come across. So I always just try my best to, you know, be as I am, show up as I am. And I think what's really important to remember is that you can be nervous. You can be vulnerable. You can show your human side without it having to negate your skill or your professionalism. It doesn't mean that I'm very capable of imparting information to those people, but I can still be nervous about it.
Mm.
So I'm not letting myself down. I'm not doing myself a disservice, but I think that's moving away from this culture and idea that we all probably grew up with of like best foot forward.
Yeah.
And that's the way we are on social media.
You're a human.
Yeah. Never show your weakness. Yeah. So never say that you were anxious about a job that you just started. Never show, like, all of this stuff that was getting in our way. When really what has made the biggest difference to me is that like human connection and just cutting the bullshit. And that's why the word bullshit was in all my book titles.
Mm. You done a tour book though?
I did, yeah, but it was during COVID that it came out, it was meant to come out and it got delayed. And do you know what? My third book is like the book I'm most proud of. It's 10 Truths to Change Your Life because they needed a kind of a catchy thing. It's called Naked, but it's about vulnerability and the power of vulnerability. But when
is that
it came,
because you're exposed?
Yeah, yeah. That's and how really that willingness to be vulnerable when you are willing to do it will give you much better connections in your life, in work, get better results, you'll problem solve faster. There's so much in it that I was really, really pleased with. But when it came out, there was no bookshops open and there was no launch event and there was no nothing. And it was...
Jingle went under the radar kind of thing.
Yeah.
And is there like charts for them books now? Like,
yeah, like, sure. Like, you can get like, number one bestseller. So a book can be number one.
So let's say you were like on the late late and you promoted that book now. Could that go to number one now?
I think it can, yeah.
Yeah, it can come. Like, sometimes you could do a media appearance and, like, obviously after I'm on this podcast.
How about we try and do that? Yeah. How about we try and get that book to number one?
No, the reason why I'm talking about your books is because I know somebody who got your first book as a gift. and that was somebody who suffers severely with anxiety. Mm-hmm. They had panic attacks. They've been to numerous counsellors, medication. They've done everything that you've been talking about there, and they said your book really helped. So coming from somebody who you're claiming that you're not qualified and you're not the expert or whatever, but for somebody who's been through everything you've just said and then looks at your book and says, that helped, that's, to me, that's a serious accolade.
Yeah. No, it's really, it's amazing. And I think what I thought would go against me has actually worked in my favor, that people, that I'm a normal person. Like, I'm not, you know, quoting from, well, I am quoting from these fancy science books, but I'm not the one coming up with them. I'm trying to distill what can be overwhelming information into something that would have helped me, something that I can understand, like plain, simple language that you don't need to be overwhelmed more when you're in that state of overwhelm to begin with. And I think people just appreciated being able to see me kind of out in the world, thriving, doing well again, getting married. Like, what, people get so, such severe anxiety about their wedding and like, how am I going to, a day where you have to be there and you can't really just, you know, well, you can if you want, but it's a lot of pressure. And like, how, if I went through that, how could I possibly have a baby? How could I be a mother? So I guess to see me doing those things, and like, I bring my anxiety along with me. But yeah, I think it's probably, people appreciate that. They think I could actually be like, not that I could be like her, but I am like her.
A functioning person.
Functioning person, yeah.
But she, I think she means more on the normal side. Yeah. She's not some superstar, fancy psychologist, celebrity person who's gone through,
I can relate to her, is the word I'm looking
years
for.
Years of experience in education. You're just like this normal woman who's had her struggles and put it out there. It's so relatable. But I think relatability is the most, is the best thing. Like, so,
relatability is the most relatable thing.
Yeah.
What it is.
You know, I was going to say that and I was like, I'm in Egypt. But I just mean, but that is exactly what I meant to say. Like, because when you're in some sort of state, whether it's anxiety or anything else in your life, when you're going through it, you just want to know that someone else is going through it or has gone through it.
Yeah.
And
I understand you.
That you're not this one in a million unfortunate cunt, you know?
That's all I wanted was to, if I could have heard from someone who was where I was and was saying, like, I promise you, you'll be okay. Because I really didn't know. Like, what if I just was never okay again?
Yeah.
And it really, I didn't really appreciate the reach that it had, or until the podcast came out, because I thought, I was like, I'll just try a little podcast. I thought it would just be one or two episodes, and that has opened me up to a whole new audience, because sometimes when you're anxious, you don't necessarily want to like open up a book, and you can listen and you can be out walking and you can receive the information in a different way. So that has been, I just didn't think I'd get to keep doing that to this day, but I am.
Private way of letting for you to cope. But as you said, like, if you're reading the book, you're sitting on the bus, people can see you're reading.
Exactly.
Anxiety,
yeah.
What's wrong with her?
Yeah.
Whereas you're listening to something, no one knows what you're listening to.
Yeah.
So it's a nice private way to digest it. You've done multiple podcasts though.
A few. Yeah.
Like your own ones.
Yeah.
You done one about becoming a mother as well.
I did one. Well, it was about, I did one called Ready to Pop, and it was when I was basically just whatever I'm going through. I'm like, how can I turn this into content? How can I make money out of this?
Wait, that's why we're actually sending Terrence away.
Yeah, he can't buy content out to Thailand. You know, something's going to happen.
So I just, that was just a little mini series I did. And I've done a few different things, like different collaborations, because I think once you know the mechanics of a podcast, it's kind of, you know, it's a good resource to tap into. And I often think, you know, you're just sitting here having a chat, but there is skill involved. And when you're on your own in isolation, you can feel like you don't have any skills. And then until you meet someone who doesn't even know what a podcast is, and you're like, oh, I can help you. So that's been interesting. But I keep just coming back to the original podcast, owning it, because that's where the audience is. It's
sorry, like, another point. She wrote the second book, and that was a bestseller as well.
Yeah, so you have two best-selling books.
You have two best-selling books.
Yeah, but you know what? They're ages ago. I need to do something else. I am trying to write a book now about, but this will be hopefully a bit more memoir-ish, because I feel like I've hopefully earned the right to be able to use my voice and not rely on everyone else's voice, about life as a parent, which is not at all what I expected.
Good crack though, isn't it?
Some of the time.
Like overall, do you know what? Something my dad said to me a couple of weeks ago, and I was like, whoa, I was blown away by it. So we were out a few weeks ago, and I was in the same pub as my man dad, and a friend of mine had twins at the end of last year. So my dad came home and he's talking to him, he's like, how are you getting on? How are you finding it? And that, they're his first kids. Like, so He was like, yeah, like it's tough. We're busy. Everywhere we go, it has to be planned out in advance. You're bringing all this stuff with you, blah, blah, blah. And my dad was like, yeah. And then he was like, sure, you know yourself because like, I'm 1 of 5. And my dad was like, you know, the only regret I have, I wish I had 3 more kids. And I was like, 3 more? Are you for real? Like, wow. There's 5 of us. And he goes, yeah, but what you don't realise is the fun I had rearing you. And I was like, whoa. Do you know what I mean? And
so
I was like,
nice.
But then, do you know,
I feel
when you
bad
think
now.
Back, now when you think back and you're like, I remember, like, obviously, I remember my childhood, but then, like, I remember watching him rearing me brothers. Mm. And, like,
yeah,
that was funny. And now I'm experiencing this with my child, and I'm like, I'm enjoying
yours?
This.
Hey.
Okay. And like, I'm enjoying this, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, this is a bit of crack, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
As much as it breaks your heart and you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Like, you can enjoy the moment of it all, you know?
Yeah,
what I mean?
I mean, I do think there's massive pressure on people to, maybe not so much when they're 8, but when they're younger and you're severely sleep deprived and hormonally all over the place and having a really shit day, and it's like, cherish the moment. And it's just this massive pressure then to be like, yeah, I can't fucking, I actually want this moment to move on. And
yeah,
then we beat ourselves up for not being able to cherish it when it's hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes it's kind of like a filtering process. Like when you come out of the hard bit, then you know, you're looking at the photos of them while they're asleep and you can kind of retroactively appreciate it. But it's hard in the moment sometimes. And I, yeah, no, I do think that's like, we could have a whole other conversation about the expectations of how we think we should be in parenting and how sometimes you just need to honor the shit bits. Because I think, well, like I kind of alluded to in this, like we've had our struggles with my son with COVID baby, maybe that's part of it, but he has really, he's like a lot of
socially,
sensory issues, yeah, and social issues, and he's just like that really tiny window of tolerance that I mentioned, and just his temperament was, I always say like he just came out of my belly just with this air of concern and I just couldn't make him happy and I felt so like, why am I not, what am I doing wrong? But I should be feeling just pure bliss and pure joy and like the crack. And I'm like, I just feel like it's more hard than it is good. And then of course that just like sent me inward on this like, you're a piece of shit kind of mother. But it's given me more content. So it's more just stuff to tease apart, I suppose, and to try and shed light on things that we maybe don't want to talk about. Like we only want to say our kids are a complete joy. And of course, God, he is the absolute light of my life. But it has been so much harder than I was prepared for.
Yeah.
And probably because of the challenges that he's had that I care so much about helping him with.
You're more aware of as well. Like
I'm really aware.
Like, oh shit, that's.
Yeah.
That's
that. And then people, they mean well, but it's like, you know, he's probably getting all that from you. And I really, it puts blame on you as a parent. And I, like, I'm so aware that I know that because of my anxiety experience that I will be such an like unbelievable support to him as he gets older, because I won't ever diminish what he's feeling. Or as a child, be like, I'd never say to him, don't be ridiculous, there's no monster under your bed. Like I wouldn't make him feel stupid. I would be like, get down to his level. And I think it's because I was there myself. So I know that in spite of my anxiety, I'm not going to make him a more anxious person. I'm going to help him be how he is, feel how he feels, go through things as well. And I think people are really frightened when they've gone through anxiety, like what I've described here. How could they ever be a mother and be responsible and take care of another person when they feel like they couldn't do it for themselves? But you've no idea the strength that you'll be able to draw from having gone through a difficult time.
The one thing that I hate is, when I knew I was going to become a dad, it's like all these experts and like you'll see people like with books and referring to doctors and all. And I remember thinking like, that just reminds me of school. Like I'm reading a curriculum on how to be a parent. And I'm like, oh. And then what I always say to like, I like mates become a dad and they're nervous. I'm like, I swear to God, trust me on this. You'll figure it out. Just when the baby comes, something just switches in your head and you're like, everything's all right.
Yeah.
Everything is grand.
We have done since the start of the time.
Exactly.
But we have too much information now.
Yeah.
I think like something that I probably got wrong was my access to experts is probably more than most people. And when I hit a difficulty, I was like, I know what I'll do. I will go. And I actually undermined myself to the point that I didn't have a gut instinct. I was so unsure and untethered. And like, especially as the woman giving birth, you're like physically all over the place after as well. I kind of silenced what I didn't allow my own, like you say, like you'll just know, it will just click. I smothered myself in expertise to the point that it was like conflicting different kind of schools of thought. And I was like, it took me a long time. And it's only recent that I'm like, I know my child. I know what he needs. I know what you're saying. I know you mean well, but no, we're going to go our own way. But that, yeah, expertise, there's such a, it's amazing the access we have to information. It's like social media is, has, I've connected with mothers who are going through similar that my own close friends maybe wouldn't be going through. And it's been amazing. But the too much opinions, too much information, too much access, it ends up adding to this constant buzz of anxiety that we all probably live with to some degree.
Yeah, that's to me, the reason why I brought that up is going back to Terrence's point about the relatability. So to hear you speak about that, I think that would put more people at ease than picking
up
a book.
But imagine how many people's going to listen there and go, oh,
I know what she's on about. I get it now. Rather than be like, my child is doing this, I'm going to read a book. Oh, but maybe it's this, what this doctor said it might be. And be like, or this woman is just going through the exact same thing as you, and she just expressed herself, and you'd be like, I know how you feel. I get it now.
Yeah, I hope so.
Well, imagine talking about it. Right?
Like when I get a message from someone saying, you know, I found your book or I found your podcast and it made a difference. Like, I know it sounds kind of like to say it, but that really is to me, like, that has to be the measure of success. That has to be why you do it.
You get paid, obviously, to fucking do what we do.
If you go and give a talk, you get a fee
or whatever. Yeah, we get paid to do shows and podcasts and you get paid to do books and whatever. But I really don't give a fuck about the money or anything like that. I really, obviously it's nice to have money. It's nice to be able to go on a holiday. And
as you said, the bills have to be paid.
But exactly. But when you get a nice, hard-hitting message of someone relating to you and seeing a brighter side of anything in life, there is no better feeling.
Yeah, and I think it's especially in the context of social media, we think we're connected, but we're actually not. Like, it's just so lacking in that. When someone takes the time to write a message and send it to someone that they've never met and worry, oh, will they even see this? Will they reply? Will they think I'm weird? And when you reply and you can have that connection, it's just, I think we need more of that in the world, right?
I hate getting, you know, when you reply to someone, you're like, oh my God, you replied. I'm like, oh, don't say that, please, don't say
that. Yeah.
Please.
Yeah.
Just your touch on social media there, and I see a lot of psychiatrists and different studies being done around it, but I still think that we're not in it long enough to be conclusive. What is your opinion on the relationship between social media and anxiety?
I think it's probably more negative than it is positive. I think our tendency to, like, towards social comparison is made, it's far too easy with social media to compare, and that is one of the, like, quickest ways to feel anxious or feel like you're not where you should be or you're not good enough, and that just, you know, can set in stone as a belief. Without that, like, if you can make your world smaller and just interact with the people who matter to you and the opinions that you value, you'll shave off a lot of that anxiety of noise. I think the frequency at which I myself, like, it's like a physical tick of picking up and needing this validation, that can only be feeding into this, it's like frenetic, frenzied energy. This, like, it's like a fizziness that we just can't, like, we're not tolerant of boredom now because of social media, because of our phones. It's this environmental, I don't mean environment like the climate, I mean like the environment in which we're in, this constant just anxiety that we all probably have to a certain degree, this background noise of anxiety, which is fueled by a lot by social media. I think we need to be aware of that. I can't be without it. Like, I've often, like, when someone sends me a nasty message and it really, you know, affects me, I would love nothing more than to just say, right, fuck everyone, I'm done. And but I can't, I have to be on social media, like yourselves, to, like, market the things that I do. I have to be there for the good benefits. And unfortunately, it seems to be like the price of admission for being vulnerable or for sharing or being able to have those good parts is that people will tear you down. And so I know that level of anxiety is probably not what everyone's dealing with. But certainly if you have any kind of audience, social media can really fuel anxiety. But then I would be worried about, like, yeah, definitely worried about kids and like how fucking brutal they can be behind the screen and with messaging. And I don't do Snapchat or anything like that, but like I have friends who have kids who are in, you know, the later ages of primary school, and the things I hear that just would not have happened. Like, it's hard enough to be a teenager, to be prepubescent, to be grown boobs and getting your period or all those, whatever happens to you guys.
You just get hairy. And you're hungry all the time.
We actually have it easy.
I think we have it worse.
That is a fair estimation. But then you add in social media where it's like people can bully in different ways. I do think there's more downsides.
I would, if we hadn't got this podcast, 1,000,000% not be on social media. I hate it.
Why do you hate it?
Because it gives me anxiety.
What gives you anxiety about it?
Anything. Doesn't matter what. When I post a podcast on a Thursday.
Is it what if they don't like it? What if they don't like me? What if
no,
I get a
message? No, it's not even that. It's just, I don't, because like you said, you're picking
probably
your phone up.
A lot,
yeah, I there's no like thing.
Yeah.
Like if I put up a picture of me and Calvin now in a pub, or if I post the podcast or anything I do on it, it's just like, I don't like it.
Yeah, because it's a vulnerable thing. You're putting yourself out there to the world and you don't know who's looking at it or who's what they're saying or thinking. Like, it is a weird, it's not a natural thing to do.
It is about, it's all just being vulnerable.
Yeah.
That's where I think it stems from, you know. Even if we're on the podcast and we're talking about serious topics, but in our own lives, and I live, I'm always like, fuck, what
shouldn't
say,
have said that. Yeah, I know.
But then it's the good reaction from people who relay or aren't like that kind of makes you
I would be nervous, not about having this chat, but I will probably, my mind will go to, I don't know what your audience is like or if they're going to be like, who's this fucking one? And so I'd get anxious about people who don't already know, because with my own audience, they kind of know what they're getting.
Like you're starting again.
Yeah, yeah, so that would, that, I mean, that would be anxiety.
We know our audience and we know.
I hope they're nice.
Yeah, that sound. Let them know. Let her know.
Yeah.
When you are out there, send her a message and let her know you've enjoyed it.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Because, it was a great episode.
Yeah.
Caroline, I really
hope
enjoyed it.
Thank you.
I really did. Genuinely.
Have you got anyone to plug while you're here, Caroline?
If I could be
no.
So.
Wrap her up.
Go ahead.
So obviously the podcast is called Owning It. It's the same as the book title. And it's really just never veers from being about anxiety. So if you're trying to better understand or manage anxiety, there'll be a different like expert on. Sometimes I do a lot of solo episodes, or there'll be someone like your good self who will hopefully come on and talk about your experience of anxiety. And that, as we say, the relatability is extra relatable. But also my latest thing is I started a Substack. Highly recommend it. And I to kind of allude to our social media not feeling safe anymore. I really didn't feel safe sharing all that I was sharing about my parenting experience and, you know, things that are personal, but I'm such a sharer. So I wanted to move it to Substack where I've got more space to write through things. I am a writer and a journalist and I wanted to write about things. So I write about everything from relationships and things that people maybe don't want to talk about to parenting to career stuff. And it's carolineforan.substack.com. /subscribe, and that's where I'm directing most of my energy right now.
Thanks for coming in, and I can't believe you're doubting yourself as well.
Thank you for having me. No, really, honestly, I appreciate it, and I it's always amazing to be able to if one more person can say, I understand a bit more now, then like that's credit
I'm
to
sure
you guys.
A lot of people will be able to relate and understand.
But to like bring that up on this podcast, you know, it's amazing. So thank you.
All right, thanks for coming in. You finished, Dirty?
Yep.
Wrap her up. Take us out, Lauren.
Boom.
Subscribe to this podcast for free on the Go Loud app.
What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Throw your weight in it now. Fill your body up in. Walk it hard and slow. When you finish that.
The Hypnoca.
Go down. Go down. Go down. Go down.